Welcome to another Vox Talk recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. My name is Tim Phillips. Nowadays, we don't tend to think so much about our social class as an invisible barrier to promotion in elite professions. But a new piece of research investigates whether it is still important in one profession that's close to home, academia. Anna Stansbury of the Sloan School at MIT was one of the researchers. When we spoke, I asked her whether the economists who research the influence of race or sex on our careers are just not as interested in social class these days.
I think a lot of people are going to be annoyed with me for saying this, but in general, the answer is they're not really. And I want to caveat that a little bit. So economists study a lot the degree to which your social class background or your socioeconomic background affects your outcomes in childhood, where you go to school, whether you go to college, where you go to college. That we study a lot, and there's great work on that. But not just economists, but basically all social scientists, and in fact, most of society more broadly, doesn't think about the fact that your social class background or your socioeconomic background might affect what happens to you even after that point, even after you've gone to the same elite university or you've got your foot in the door of the same intro program at a big job.
You've set out in this case to measure the influence of that class background on the career progression in academia. I don't mean to be rude about this, but academia is a strange profession. It's very elite. Why do we choose to study it?
It is a strange profession. The main reason I'm choosing to study it is because we have data on people's social class background. So you've got to look for your keys under where the streetlight is, right? We would be interested in looking across all elite professions and asking, when someone from a less advantaged background makes it into this elite profession, what happens then? Just as we ask, if someone from a racial minority makes it into an elite profession, what happens then? But mostly we don't have the data, most surveys don't collect it. In US academia, there's a very big representative survey that, as it happens, does collect some data, and that's why we're looking there.
And we need to be precise about our terms. What do we normally mean by class in this context? We all use the word. I'm not sure we all use it in the same way.
I agree with that. And luckily, sociology has spent a lot of time thinking about how to define class much more precisely than we have in economics. So borrowing from them, the way I'm thinking about class background is the degree to which your background has given you resources that enable you to be successful and achieve social status and wealth later in life. So that could be your parents' income and wealth. It could be your parents' education level. It could be your parents' occupation and other resources that aren't just from your parents. Ideally, you'd capture all of those.
Okay, so your research deals with progress along the tenure track for academics. Now, for anyone from an academic background who's listening to this now, they know exactly what you're talking about. Non-academics, probably not. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, I didn't know what it was before I became an academic either. So tenure track is after you get your PhD, particularly in the US, but also in some other countries, the path to becoming a research professor whose job mostly focuses on research involves getting first a tenure track job where you then have 6 to 8 years to do a lot of very good research and demonstrate to your university that they want to keep you on for life, which is the tenure job.
You've mentioned that we have this information on the socioeconomic background, which is great because when you apply for a job, you're not asked about it and you wouldn't know what to put even if you were. How many economists does that mean that you have in this data set applying for these jobs, getting these jobs?
Our data actually covers all STEM PhD recipients in the US. So that's science, technology, engineering, math, and all the social sciences. So most of our paper, we're looking across all of these folks. And we've got about 80,000 people from all these different disciplines from their PhD at different points in their career. And this is in the US, this data. Of just economists, we don't really break out just economists, but we have a few thousand economists.
It's quite a big data set, isn't it?
It's big.
Now, from this data set, are you finding that there is a class gap in tenure track jobs?
It'd be a bit of a letdown if I wasn't after all this.
Well, yes, why are we here?
Yeah. So yes, is the answer to that. We find quite a big, what we call class gap in career progression. Take two people from the same PhD program, and this is crucial. So two people who did their PhD in economics at Michigan or wherever it is. The person from a less advantaged background, which we classify here as a first generation college grad, so someone where neither parent went to college. This obviously captures a whole range of backgrounds. That person is about 13% less likely to end up at a high-profile, research-intensive tenure-track or tenured job than someone from the same PhD program who had a parent from a more advantaged background.
Gosh, and is that gap closed later? Can they make up for it, or is it persistent?
It's persistent. And in fact, if anything, wow, we find that it seems to widen a little bit. So you've got the first job you get after your PhD, your tenure track job. And then in your tenure track job, you get promoted to tenure or you don't get tenure. And we also find that there's a gap at that promotion stage.
And you've taken care to match for the PhD program, because my first intuition on this was that people who come from a background where they have parents who went through academia as well, or perhaps a higher social status background, would know about getting into those good PhD programs, which has a huge effect. This doesn't apply in this case.
Yeah, exactly. If we're thinking about the question, why is academia not very socioeconomically diverse? Almost all the action is happening up until the point you're saying, right? The action is happening in terms of who goes to which university, who then goes to which PhD program.
Yeah.
But what I'm interested in is the question, even when someone from a less advantaged background has jumped through all those hoops and made it that far, then do we still see a gap? Because we do see gaps like that for race and gender, and close to no one is studying this for class. I should caveat, especially for UK listeners, there's a fantastic book called The Class Ceiling,
yes,
by two sociologists, Sam Friedman and Daniel Laurison, which does do this in certain UK occupations. And perhaps not surprising, anyone in the UK does find these gaps as well.
Yes, the British class system is something that we have all experienced and all worried about at various times. We know that race and socioeconomic background, they are quite closely correlated. Do you control for this in your results?
We control for race in all our analyses for exactly that reason. Mm. So the way you can think about our results is we're comparing two people of the same race who have different parental education backgrounds. One thing to bear in mind, of course, is that they're correlated. Someone who's African-American in academia in the US is also more likely to be a first-generation college grad. And those two sources of disadvantage might actually be intersectional. So they might actually make the situation even more difficult than the sum of its parts.
Of course. So I mentioned before that we have discussed the influence of race and the influence of gender before. How does the result that you have here, how does it compare to the known effects of race and gender on career progression?
So the big takeaway is these magnitudes of these gaps are about the same size. They're the same order of magnitude. So if we care about race and gender gaps at this stage in the career, we should also care about class gaps because they're a similar size. Now, the interesting thing is they're kind of different in the way they emerge. So gender gaps in academia in the US at this stage are mostly emerging in terms of who stays in academia and who doesn't. Women are much less likely to end up in a tenure track or tenure job, but if they do, they're doing just as well as the men on average.
Mm-hmm.
Not in terms of salary, interestingly, but in terms of the kinds of jobs they're placed in.
Right.
And the race front, different racial groups have also a lot of different selection in and out of academia. African Americans are more likely to stay in academia rather than go to the private sector. Asian Americans are more likely to go to the private sector. You see these different patterns, but then there are also big race gaps when you stay. On the class front, it's all about where you end up placed. There's no difference in whether people stay in academia. There doesn't seem to be a difference in preferences about leaving academia, going to the private sector. It all seems to be about what kinds of job, what quality of job someone gets at the end of it.
So I'm interested in the why, well, the explanation, the mechanism for this is. Is there perhaps an explanation that tenure track applicants from these lower socioeconomic status backgrounds have in some way been less productive? Because it's all about the productivity when you get tenure, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you asked at the beginning, why do we study academia? And, you know, I said it's because we have the data, we're looking under the streetlight. There's another aspect of this, which is actually important in academia, which is we can see productivity. And in most jobs, you can't see that. We have data on everyone's research output. So we can see their papers, what journals they published in, how many citations they have, what their authorship order was, because in the sciences, if you're first or last or wherever else this matters.
Mm-hmm.
So we can use all of that to see, is this explained by people's differential research productivity? And the big takeaway is no, mostly not.
Oh.
Perhaps a little bit, but most of the class gap in outcomes in terms of who ends up tenured at highly ranked or research intensive universities is there, even when you compare people with similar quality research output.
Okay, so the mystery remains. I fall back on the sorts of assumptions that I normally make for how socioeconomic status influences careers. Is it social networks? Is it that they're more ambitious for high status jobs?
With all this mechanism stuff now, I'm going to have to be more speculative. The one that we can measure well is the research productivity. The rest of these, we have to do a bit of guesswork and collate with other sources. So on the networks front, we can see part of people's networks because we can see some of their co-authors.
Right.
And so I have a pretty strong guess that networks is playing a big role, that it's harder for people who are from less advantaged backgrounds to form effective, strong relationships with potential mentors, with famous people in the field who can write them recommendation letters, with potential co-authors, all of these sort of important professional relationships. And this will affect what kinds of jobs they get, whether they get promoted and what their reputation is more broadly. We can see a bit of evidence that suggests this with our co-authorship networks. So there's a common finding already that people of the same race are more likely to co-author with each other. People of the same gender are more likely to co-author with each other. And for race and gender, people have argued this reflects a difficulty in forming networks across difference,
yes,
which is a problem if you're from a small group. So if there's a minority of women in the field and it's easier to co-author with women, women have smaller potential networks. Exactly the same thing seems to be happening for socioeconomic backgrounds. So we find that first-gen college grads are more likely to co-author with other first-gen college grads than you would expect based on their co-authors' other characteristics, like what institution they're employed at, what field they're in. And that's suggestive to us that it's more difficult to form these networks also across social class backgrounds, and therefore that it shrinks the potential network that first-gen college grads can have, particularly at elite places where the share of first-gen college grads is quite small.
What about my ambition explanation?
Okay, so that one we can't see at all. We don't know.
Right.
One thing we can see is people's self-reported preferences. This survey asks people 10 factors about their job and, you know, how important is salary, how important is intellectual challenge, all these different things. We can compare those by socioeconomic background, comparing people from the same PhD program. We don't find any evidence that there's less ambition in the sense of people from less advantaged backgrounds looking for jobs that are less intellectually challenging or lower paid or anything. If anything, we find that people from less advantaged backgrounds place more weight on salary and benefits, and the higher paying institutions are also the more prestigious ones. So ambition itself, we don't find much evidence of. It could be a different valuation of what ambition means, and we can't quite get at that. You know, does ambition mean going to the most elite university as ranked by some ranking? Does it mean going to the university that the kids of all the famous politicians and business people go to? Does it mean going to the university that is the flagship in the state you grew up in and teaches a lot of the kids that come from backgrounds like yours? There's an aspect there where ambition might mean different things, but the broadest, you know, is there a different gap in ambition? Once you're looking at people that come from the same PhD program, doesn't look like there is.
Right. Even if we can't completely explain it at the moment, you've uncovered something pretty significant here. And it's pretty significant for academia as well, because academics pride themselves of being in a business that's very, very meritocratic. This evidence that you've uncovered, does it undermine that idea of a meritocracy?
Yes, I think so. Academia is a lot more meritocratic probably than a lot of professions, because we at least have some measures of productivity that are observable, and we have a self-conception of meritocracy.
Mm-hmm.
But we are humans, and we're humans operating in a world that contains a lot of prejudice and bias and differential ability to form connections with people. And I think it's a really destructive illusion to believe that we are not subject to those biases, because if we do, then we don't take action to counteract them. And I mean, I think it's the same with gender and race, but I think it's almost even more insidious with socioeconomic background. Because the reaction that I've got from a lot of people is, oh, there's no discrimination by socioeconomic background because you can't really see it. I'm not looking at someone and going, they're from X background and therefore I'm not going to hire them. And there's sort of an assumption among economists that that's how a lot of race and gender discrimination works. I actually think the more insidious part of disparities across all these metrics is the stuff that is not conscious, but it's happening because it's harder to get opportunities, it's harder to form relationships, it's harder to get that mentor that advocates for you. And that means you end up being someone that's very intrinsically able to contribute to academia, but doesn't have the chance to do so in the same way as others do.
Yes, considering this bias is so insidious, in your words, you cannot fix your class either. You can't change it, certainly not by the time you've got a PhD. Does this mean that this is also an unfixable problem, this gap?
You can't change your class background, you can't change your race, mm-hmm. You can't change your gender. If the solution is make everyone the most advantaged group, yeah, then yeah, that's not going to happen. There are things that we could do better. And part of that involves figuring out what actually the source of the problem is. So if my hypothesis that networks matter is part of it, and it's more difficult to form effective relationships, well, there's things that we could do. We could improve mentorship. We could make PhD programs less kind of sink or swim. You're not required to believe that you're entitled to the time of a Nobel laureate to get good mentorship in a PhD program. You know, someone will reach out and mentor you. Mm-hmm. You could think about having a more equitable dissemination process for opportunities so that you're not reliant on hearing from people about the potential to get a grant or whatever that is. There's a lot of stuff that can be done that improves transparency and opportunity across the board that can help bring people in. And I think there's a lot that can be done just on the awareness front as well. So in this book, The Class Ceiling by Sam Friedman and Daniel Laurison, they talk a lot about the concept of polish and the idea that actually what people think of as polish or professionalism is very class coded, how people speak, yeah, how they present themselves, how they dress. And I think that happens in academia all the time. And helping people be aware of those subliminal judgments that they're making about what it counts to be brilliant, I think that's probably also class coded. And I think we could do more on that front too.
Well, being aware of the problem is the first step to fixing it. Thank you for making us aware of it, Anna.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
The paper is called The Class Gap in Career Progression, Evidence from US Academia. And the authors are Anna Stansbury and Kyra Rodriguez.
Next on Vox Talks Economics, in the first of three episodes to mark International Women's Day, we investigate the strange history of labour laws designed to protect women.